This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure to have with us today for a podcast, Penny Venetis, the clinical professor of law and co-director of the Constitutional Litigation Clinic at Rutgers Law School. Professor Venetis is a specialist in civil rights and international human rights impact litigation, with a specific focus on the interplay between international human rights law and U.S. constitutional law. Therefore, she's very well situated to speak with us about the important case that the Supreme Court recently heard oral arguments on, Kiobel v. Royal Dutch Petroleum, which, in an interesting turn of events, the court's recently taken the unusual step of deciding to hold the case over to the October 2012 term with further briefing and more oral arguments scheduled. Now this case involves what's a relatively obscure law for those of us who aren't in the international human rights law world, and it's the 1789 Alien Tort Statute. Professor Venetis, what does that law provide for, and what's the underlying claim here in the Kiobel case?
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jim, for inviting me to participate in this podcast. You're right in saying that this is a very important case that the Supreme Court is considering, because not only will it determine basically how corporations can do business around the globe, but it seems that by asking for additional argument, that the court is going to determine the scope of the Alien Tort Statute that was enacted in 1789. You're right in saying that the statute was enacted long ago, but it really is far from obscure. It was enacted by our first Congress, which means that it was something that the Congress thought that was very, very important. And interestingly, it was enacted without very much wrangling. We know today that Congress is gridlocked in passing the most basic measures, but for the first Congress, this seemed to be a no-brainer. And the statute appears in the Judiciary Act, and it says very simply that federal courts will have jurisdiction to hear claims, tort claims, that deal with a violation of the law of nations or a treaty. And it gives specific rights to aliens to sue in U.S. courts to uphold their rights under customary international law or the law of nations. Now, customary international law means that there are certain basic principles that underlie all civilized nations, and those include the prohibition against torture, the prohibition against slavery, the prohibition against piracy, and basically customary international law means that all nations abide by these basic core principles, and they really don't need to be written down anywhere.
Well, but before we get into the specifics of the actual claim here, I think some of the critics on the other side here that have been skeptical of some of this application of the Alien Tort Statute would say that the law of nations, as it was understood in 1789, is quite a bit different than it is today. Prohibition against slavery obviously wasn't customary international law in 1789. Prohibition against torture, et cetera. These are all relatively modern shifts in the international law. And is your argument basically that that's irrelevant to the application of this law? And if so, why?
Well, it's not that it's irrelevant. It's just the nature of customary international law. As the Supreme Court said in 2004 in the case Sosa versus Alvarez Machain, which is its only interpretation of the Alien Tort Statute that exists, the law of nations is ever-evolving. It really, customary international law is something that the global community believes is anathema. So you're right, in 1789, slavery was not considered anathema, but piracy was. And since then, slavery has become illegal in all of the world, so it is one of those basic human rights principles or basic legal principles that every nation endorses, which is that you cannot enslave someone. The founders and members of our first Congress could not have envisioned life as it exists today. And the Supreme Court found that customary international law is not static. It is actually something that changes to incorporate the principles of society as it exists when you're actually trying to determine what the principles of customary international law are.
Okay, so now looking at this case more specifically, Kia Bell's the plaintiff. Who's Kia Bell and the defendant's Royal Dutch Petroleum, and what exactly is the claim involved here? In other words, what's Kia Bell's complaint, and why should Royal Dutch Petroleum be on the hook under the Alien Tort Statute for an international law violation?
All right, well, this is a lawsuit that was brought under the Alien Tort Statute, as we've been talking about, and it's basically related to the laying of a pipeline in the Niger Delta, which, as we all know, is oil-rich. And the plaintiffs were villagers that were displaced because of this pipeline, and they allege that Royal Dutch Petroleum and Shell Transport and Trading Company, working through a Nigerian subsidiary, basically assisted the Nigerian government in committing human rights violations against those the villagers. And those human rights violations are very severe. They include killings, torture, forced exile, and other serious violations. And what the plaintiffs say is that the defendant corporations helped these violations take place by providing all sorts of services to the Nigerian forces that actually committed them, such as transportation, and they allowed their property, corporate property, to be used, and they provided food and even compensation to the individuals of the Nigerian forces who committed the actual atrocities.
So now, as I understand it, before we look at how the Supreme Court's thinking about this case, reading the decision below in the Second Circuit, you had a 2-1 split decision with Pierre Laval in dissent and the majority opinion written by Jose Cabranes. And Judge Cabranes' decision, as I read it, is basically saying that this claim's invalid because international law, under customary international law, doesn't provide for lawsuits against corporations. Am I reading that right? And what do you think of that claim by the Second Circuit?
Well, you're absolutely right in the way that you depict Judge Cabranes' decision, but he is wrong. Every other circuit court that decided issues concerning corporate liability after Kiobel was decided said that Judge Cabranes got it completely wrong, and they upheld basically 30 years of lower federal court decisions that found that corporate liability was possible under the Alien Tort Statute. And there is a very long concurring opinion by Judge Laval, over 50 pages long, pointing out the many ways in which Judge Cabranes is wrong, and also pointing out that the Second Circuit itself is the birthplace of international human rights jurisprudence under the ATS. And there are a number of corporate liability cases that the Second Circuit considered since it initiated this area of jurisprudence in 1980. So the Second Circuit itself heard several cases involving corporate liability and never found them to be problematic. And it seems that Judge Cabranes basically, and the other judge who voted with him, that they stand alone.
So this case came to the Supreme Court, and it came under this sort of corporate review theory, but also a sort of fundamental jurisdictional question the court was wrestling with. In other words, is this a federal common law question? Is it a jurisdictional question, and what have you?
Well, it's not a question. It's not that. I mean, the court decided the jurisdictional issue in SOSA 8 years ago. The court was very, very clear that the Alien Tort Statute was not purely jurisdictional. It could have said it's jurisdictional and that there's no actual substantive element of the statute, but it didn't. It said not only was the statute jurisdictional, meaning that federal courts can hear cases dealing with a violation of customary international law, the court said that Congress in 1789 would not have just enacted a jurisdictional statute and let it sit on the shelf. That implied in this statute that sounds jurisdictional is actually that it would, courts would have the ability to hear certain types of claims of severe nature, such as piracy-related claims. So the court was not dealing with jurisdictional issues. What the court was examining initially, what it said it wanted to examine, was this whole notion of corporate liability to resolve this split among the circuit courts, whereas I said earlier, Judge Cabranes stands alone. So that's what all of the parties and all of the amici believed going into the argument. But what came up very quickly in oral argument was that the court really was interested in this notion of extraterritoriality. And by that I mean whether or not U.S. courts, federal courts, sitting in the United States have the ability to hear lawsuits that involve abuses or violations of rights that occurred far from our soil.
And so that's how do you read them? They've subsequently said they want rebriefing, re-argument, answering the question about whether and under what circumstances the Alien Tort Statute allows courts to recognize a cause of action for violations of the law of nations occurring within the territory of a sovereign other than the U.S. That's basically what you're saying they want to answer now. I mean, what's your sense about how the court's going to go on this? Because it's to an outside observer, perhaps it may seem strange that U.S. courts would be the appropriate forum for trying human rights violations, even assuming arguendo that they occurred exactly as alleged, by a company aiding and abetting a foreign government in a foreign land against foreign citizens. That would strike many of us as odd that a U.S. federal court would be the appropriate forum to hear that type of claim.
Well, I know it might sound odd, but many of our laws sound odd. We don't have the courts making this up. We have the first Congress of the United States enacting the statute. And when you put it in a historical context, it makes sense. In 1789, just right after the Revolutionary War, the United States and our elected officials had the foresight to realize that if we were going to be a major player in the global economy, that we really had to offer the superpowers who were very far away. It took weeks, if not months, to get here from Europe. We had to offer those superpowers of the day assurance that our courts would offer justice and that our courts would actually observe the rule of law regardless of one's citizenship. So that's why it was a special statute created to benefit aliens. And again, the aliens in mind were the superpowers of the day. So it was brilliant foresight on behalf of the first Congress. And at the time that the Alien Tort Statute was enacted, piracy was the scourge of the world. There were pirates that were hijacking European vessels and American vessels, enslaving the crew and stealing all of the cargo.
Those
actions did not take place on U.S. soil. They took place on open sea outside of the U.S.'s borders. And it's very, very clear that that was one of the torts that Congress had in mind when it enacted the statute.
Sure.
It was something that occurred extraterritorially, and there are a number of history books that talk about this.
Right, but wouldn't there be a distinction, perhaps, between enforcing international law to give the owners of a British frigate recourse in U.S. courts when Blackbeard the pirate in the Atlantic Ocean off the North Carolina coast took the frigate, and, for instance, enforcing liability against the British East India Company for being involved in piracy against a French frigate off the coast of Morocco? I mean, aren't these fundamentally different, and wouldn't they have been viewed as different under the concepts of law in place by the time the statute was written?
Well, I mean, I don't live in the 18th century, but the statute was very open-ended. It did not define who the defendants can be. It said that any violation of the law of nations could be adjudicated in U.S. courts. Now, it's up to the courts to determine what falls within this category of a violation of the law of nations, right? But the Congress was very clear that our courts would at least be open to hear it, and then the parties could make their argument.
Right.
Now, interestingly, in 1991, Congress enacted something called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And as Justice Kagan said during oral argument, and this is a commonly held belief and legal interpretation, is that when that statute was enacted, it was meant to enhance the Alien Tort Statute. And what the Torture Victim Protection Act states, and it was enacted, again, not too long ago, in, 20 years ago, it says that U.S. courts have jurisdiction to hear cases involving torture, wherever that torture may have occurred. So Congress essentially put its stamp of approval on the ATS and its extraterritorial jurisdiction by not overturning it in 1991 when it enhanced it. If Congress thought that there was a problem with this, or if the court thought that there was a problem with this notion of extraterritorial jurisdiction, it certainly would have done something in 1991 about it, and it certainly would not have made very clear in terms for torture and extrajudicial killing cases that our courts do have extraterritorial jurisdiction to hear these cases. There are many cases that were brought under the TVPA, Torture Victim Protection Act, and those cases all occurred extraterritorially.
Great. Well, I've got one more quick question, and then we'll wrap up. And I think that's a good argument in terms of congressional affirmation there. Then just stepping back to the broader constitutional question, since that's a lot of your focus and your own scholarship, Justice Alito was asking the question along these lines, though, in the oral argument, regardless of what Congress wants to do, what's the Article III hook that would confer upon federal courts jurisdiction under the Constitution to hear claims from an alien plaintiff against an alleged alien tortfeasor for alleged torts that occurred on alien soil?
Well, all Article III does is establishes a federal court system, right? So Article III of the Constitution says that there's a certain type of judge, an Article III judge, who's appointed for life, and who has to be confirmed by the Senate before the president appoints him or her. That's what Article III does. And the statute itself answers the question. The statute says that federal courts have jurisdiction to hear these cases. That's what the ATS says, enacted by our first Congress, and that's what the Torture Victim Protection Act says, that Article III courts do have jurisdiction over this. So I think that Justice Alito was trying to wrap his head around the notion of extraterritoriality, which we've been talking about, and that's why the court wants to hear additional argument. But I don't think necessarily that that's a bad thing. It certainly is unusual that the court has done it, but I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I think there are a number of cases, alien tort statute cases, wending their way through the system, and they're all making their way one by one up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And to me, it seems that the court really wants to take care of these unanswered questions, once and for all. That it's going to consider these open questions that it's never spoken about in SOSA and in any other case. And it really wants to address it, all at once, rather than piecemeal every few years. So I think that that's certainly one way to interpret the court's actions. The other is that it is concerned about this, truly is concerned about this issue of extraterritoriality. And since it wasn't an issue in the Kiobel case, because, again, the Second Circuit didn't have any problems with it. After all, the Second Circuit decided Falardiga in 1980 that was the mother of all of these international human rights cases in U.S. courts. So the Second Circuit didn't even think that was an issue, extraterritoriality, and neither did the Supreme Court in SOSA. But anyway, Justice Alito was not on the court when SOSA was decided, and it's clear that he had concerns about it, and the court wants the parties to actually brief it so that they can really resolve all of these issues, and then the lower courts and litigants will have a clearer sense of what the law is surrounding the alien tort statute.
Fascinating stuff. Well, this has been very illuminating. Again, I'd really like to thank Professor Penny Venetis for joining us. Again, this is James Copeland from the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute, talking about an important Supreme Court case, which is stretching over into the 2012-2013 term. Thanks again, Professor Venetis.
Thanks so much, Jim.